So today we're going to go ahead and do another Perkia vote, and this is a short one. Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom. Today we're going to read Mishnah number 8 from Perkia vote. It is Aleph Het, for those of you who are looking up in Hebrew. Mishnah number 8, Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom. And I'm going to let Stacy read the actual Mishnah here.
Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetak received the tradition from them. Yehuda ben Tabai says, "When serving as a judge, do not act as a lawyer. While the litigants stand before you, consider them both as guilty. But when they are dismissed from you, consider them both as innocent, provided they have accepted the judgment."
This is really interesting because when you look at it, it's saying a judge. And this is a judge, you know, in Israel, you know, the inventor, for lack of a better term, of judges. You know, God used Israel to bring justice upon the earth through judges. If there is a dispute, then who's going to arbitrate the dispute? A judge, right? Why does oral law exist? Because if someone says, you know, me and Joel, Joel is saying, well, I'm keeping Torah by doing this. And I say, I'm keeping Torah by doing this. But they have an effect on something between me and Joel. And we can't quite figure out when both of us are looking, thinking we're keeping Torah. Well, who's to come and say what we should do? A judge or an arbiter or someone that has some type of authority to make a judgment, someone who understands Torah, all of these things. So as we're reading through this, I want you to think about it like this. Many of us here have children, in particular multiple children. And there's some kind of problem or some kind of argument or some type of disagreement between the children. And you've got to be this judge or this, you know, person who's got to bring resolution to this situation. And, you know, as parents, the last thing you want to see is your children not getting along, right? You don't want to see that. And then by the same token, you don't want to be the one who has to bring this judgment upon one in front of the other, all that kind of thing. Judging situations and judging people, it's not something anyone ever really wants to do. That makes sense? But look what he says here, when serving as a judge. So if you're in a position where you have to judge something, don't act as a lawyer. What does that even mean? Don't try and defend one side or the other. Or don't try and accuse one side or the other, right? You're not there to be a lawyer. You're there to be a judge. You know, this is what happened. He said this. That one said that. I've got to judge it. Not to get on one side and accuse one or defend the other or defend one and accuse the other. Don't act as a lawyer. While the litigants stand before you, consider them both as guilty. You know, if you consider both of them guilty, then you're not acting, you're not releasing one. You're holding them both to account, right? But when they are dismissed from you, consider them both as innocent. Once the judgment has been ruled, that's it, it's done. You don't look at them, even you don't even look at the guilty one as guilty anymore. Consider them both innocent, because why? It's a done deal. It's all over. But you only consider them both as innocent if they've accepted the judgment. I remember back in the 80s, there was Judge Wapner on the original People's Court, you know, later took over by Judge Judy. But one thing they'd always do is after the judgment was ruled, typically, I'd say 95%+ of the time, you'd have one person really happy and the other one feeling like they weren't heard and, you know, they got the short end of the stick. And so what would they do? They had the little guy, Doug Llewellyn, and he stood in the foyer. I used to watch these things a lot. I remember the guy's name. And he was a very uncomplicated, neutral party there just to do the interviews. He would ask, well, what do you think? And one would say, well, the judge saw it, and she saw, or he saw it right, and victory has prevailed, or the righteousness has prevailed, right? Then the other one come up with the exact opposite idea. Sometimes there are words between them. Why? Because sometimes they didn't want, there's always, typically one who doesn't want to accept the ruling, right? But consider them both innocent, provided they both have accepted the judgment. Occasionally you would see people come out and say, oh, you know what? This is a terrible thing that happened. I wish it wouldn't have happened, but it did. And now can we get past this? I'm sorry, Jewel, for my part. I never want to have any type of problem with you again in something. You know, and you come up to me and say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, for my part, you know, here is, what does Jewel bring with him? A jar of honey. Here's a jar of honey. Oh, and now we're friends again. And then the judge can look upon us and say, you know, God in heaven can look upon us and say they're both innocent. This matter has been resolved. Hallelujah. Let's look at what the rabbis further said about this.
Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach received their tradition from them, from Yehoshua ben Perachah and Nittai of Arbel. Even though Yehuda ben Tabai is mentioned first, there is a dispute as to whether he was the Nasi or the Av Beit Din.
Pause right here. I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'm going to give you a quick little tidbit of something. You have in Judaism what are called the Zugot. Anybody know what Zugot is, what it means in Hebrew? It means pairs. And I don't want to get into this too much because one day I'm going to teach on it. It means pairs. The most, yes. Oh, no, not a P-E-A-R, but a P-A-I-R. Thank you for saying that. Like, you know, it's, yeah, like a zygote or a baby, right? When I first read the term, that's what I thought about. So you have this idea of pairs. Who are the pairs? Well, in to make a very, we're going to talk about this. Pairs were set, there were five of them were set to create oral law. And what they did was they argued these ideas back and forth. But they always argued them from the other point of view. Nittai of Arbel and Yehoshua ben Perachiah were two of these pairs. One of them from each side was always the Av Beit Din, which was basically the, you could say, the vice president of the Sanhedrin, and the other one, the Nasi, or the prince, or was the president of the Sanhedrin. And they would argue these things back and forth in front of people so that they could come up with case law. How do we handle this when this happens? What do we do? The last of the Av Beit Din of the five pairs was names that you'll recognize, Hillel and Shammai. So when they're talking about there's a dispute to whether one was, who was the president, who was the vice president, that's what it's referring to. But these were two of the five pairs, the five Zugot, who would argue these things. They argued 316 cases, specific things, to come up with a solution how to deal with it. Of the 316, I think 286 were won by the Pharisees and the rest by the Sadducees. We'll talk more about this. Don't quote me on those numbers. But the vast majority was won by one side. So give me one sec. So the idea of where does this stuff come from? It comes from the men who they set up, the five Zugot, that they set up to discuss these things from both sides. So then when you discuss an argument from both sides, by the time you're done arguing it, you have a better idea of what the... You'll know both sides. It's important to know what people who think the opposite of you believe, right? So you can talk to them about it. and understand where they're coming from. Understand where they're quote unquote wrong or quote unquote right or quote unquote we in agreement. Go ahead, Case.
Did they need to have five sets? Were there five total or were there five all the time?
There were five sets. Last set, one of the sets, I think these were second and third, I don't remember exactly. One of the sets was Yehoshua ben Pechaya and Nittai of Arbel. They're one of the sets. They're one of the Zugot.
So there would only be one set at a time?
There was only one set at a time, mm-hmm. And five sets existed, the last of which was Hillel and Shammai. And we know, I don't have it in front of me the dates, but I can tell you this. The last ones lived, according to my memory here, Hillel and Shammai, one of them died when Yeshua was a child, and the other one died when Yeshua was an adult. So Yeshua was very familiar with them, and then we see the son of Hillel lived within Yeshua's time, the great Gamaliel. So when you have the situation of them coming before the Sanhedrin to decide what should we do with the disciples who are out preaching, we've beaten them, we've thrown them in prison, they're still out teaching this Jesus thing, Yeshua. What are we going to do? And then who stands up? Gamaliel stands up, son of Hillel. But was he one of the pairs, the Zugot? No, but he was highly expected. He would have been the Nasi the prince or the president of the Sanhedrin at the time. So I don't want to stay in that because it comes up here, so I just want to mention who these guys are. Yes. When I teach it, I'll tell you all five of them. I don't have them in front of me. They're in. We'll get to it in the coming weeks as we continue through the loudest silent years. No, do you have your mic? Ask that into the mic because people who are listening, I want them to hear these questions too.
Does it say who the first two were in the Bible or is that just in the Mishnah?
No, so these men existed. This is what happened during the 400 years. This is what happened when, as part of, after the exile, the men of Israel, they came back into the land. They established a synagogue and everything. And this is part of it, is how do we do it together? How do we need to have some type of case law or precedent to decide things that happen. When a case or something comes before you, what do? How do we even decide what happens? Who's right, who's wrong, what is the standard, et cetera, yeah. No, in that 400 years, yes. And they were one after the other. It wasn't a situation, they didn't exist together at the same time, they were continuous. And again, they debated 316 particular topics. So now that you know who these guys are, again, Yehoshua ben Pechaya and Nittai of Arbel. Okay, here we go. Even though Yehuda ben Tobiah is mentioned first, there is dispute whether he was the Nasir of Beit Din, head of the court. Following the opinion that he was indeed the Nasir, basically the president, in the Jerusalem Talmud, it relates how he came to occupy that position. The citizens of Jerusalem sought to appoint Yehuda ben Tobiah over themselves. Oh, wow, this is something I was going to teach on. It's already in here. Okay. Oh, well, we'll do it. In his modesty, he fled to Alexandria, Egypt, rather than accept such a prestigious position. Those in Jerusalem sent the following message. From the great Jerusalem to the humble Alexandria, how long with my betrothed Yehuda ben Tobiah reside in your midst while I sit here brokenhearted? Yehuda ben Tobiah subsequently returned and accepted the position of Nasi. It should be noted that the office of Nasi was fraught with much danger during the murderous reign of King Yanai. Shimon ben Shittak was the brother of Yanai's queen, Shlomis Alexandria, known as Shlomzion. When Yanai purged the Torah sages, Shlomi's Alexandria, hid her brother. And by the time he was able to return to public life, he was the sole remaining member of the Sanhedrin, still loyal to Torah Judaism. All the rest were Sadducees, who denied the validity of the oral law. Because of his wisdom and shrewdness, he was eventually able to oust the Sadducees from the Sanhedrin. In Christianity, there's this idea, we see Jesus, and they say, oh, goodness, you know, he was crucified. Oh, my. Almost as though that had never happened to anybody else. Now, clearly, obviously, that was significant, Messiah. To a Jew, that was something that happened to their people all the time, by the thousands. Thousands of rabbis were crucified and executed. Thousands of the sages. And it's documented. It's not something that, you know, there's no record or anything. No, it's all documented. And this particular man, Shimon ben Shetach, he had to go into hiding to survive. And by the time he came out, all of his contemporaries were dead. It was just him. Because of his wisdom and shrewdness, he was eventually able to oust the Sadducees from the Sanhedrin. There were times in the Sanhedrin where it was led mainly by Pharisees, when it was led mainly by Sadducees, and it went back and forth for different reasons over a long period of time. Among Shimon ben Shetach's many achievements were two major enactments. He instituted the Kesubah or Ketubah. Anybody know what a Ketubah is, Judy? A marriage certificate. There you go. Thank you. Expanding the protection of women. This idea that within Judaism, women were treated bad and they were, no. Women were looked upon as, I mentioned to you before, as they were recognized as being able to have a higher place spiritually, a higher understanding spiritually than men. And when you have a, when you look at this institution of the ketubah or a marriage document, women had rights. They had official rights. They had unofficial rights within the community. They had official rights with a something written, a ketubah, a marriage document. And he established the first Jewish elementary schools, particularly for the benefit of children orphaned from their fathers. Such children typically had no home to teach them Torah, so the schools were a necessity. Again, you remember, what was the tithe and the offering for that went to the temple? Widows and orphans. What happens when there's no temple? What happens to the widows and orphans? You know, they're supposed to go back to their families, right? But what happens if all of a sudden there's no one, nowhere to go? You remember the story of the seven. It's either five or seven women who their husbands were dead. And they had no family. They had no birthright. They had nothing. Does God basically say, okay, because I don't have a specific way of taking care of you, you're just left out? No. Torah was already written, so what do? Well, you have people who are you've left in charge, right? That can make decisions on earth, this partnership we talk about all the time. Go ahead, yeah.
Is that what they're talking about when, I forget which Brit Hadashah book it's in, but it's saying appoint deacons to see after the widows?
Well, that's part of it because that's part of it from the standpoint of God's people are in charge. They can actually make decisions. And they can make a decision, especially when there's no when there's a specific need that Torah doesn't address. What do? Somebody's got to make a decision. That's the decisions that they made. What you're talking about in particular is the when all of a sudden there was this new thing happening where many Jews were coming to Messiah. And when they were coming to Messiah, what happened? You had many Jews from different sects of Judaism coming to Messiah. Now all of a sudden, they've got to come and work together and be one. And some were saying, hey, you know, we weren't getting our distribution. Our widows are going hungry here. What are we going to do? And they brought this to the apostles, to the, and they said, look, we don't have time dealing with, you know, these widows over here. I mean, aren't there some men here who can just deal with that and leave us alone to go do this? They had authority to still make halakah. And they did. Who did? The Jewish people. The leaders of Israel, they still did. They made halakah. That's practiced by the churches today. In particular, like the Presbyterians, that's their big claim to fame. The presbyters, the deacons. But a lot of them don't know where it came from, but they practice it. And if you guys have a question or comment, just...
Yehuda ben Tobai says, when serving as a judge, do not act as a lawyer. A judge must always remain an impartial arbiter. Even if he is convinced that one of the parties is right, he should not advise that litigant on how to present his case. Rambam explains, as those who conduct a mock trial prior to the real one, thus preparing arguments and rebuttals for every eventuality, a judge may not participate in such an exercise. In certain extraordinary instances, when particular pieces of evidence have not been properly stressed by one of the litigants due to ignorance, weakness, or awkwardness, the judges are required to intercede and open the mouth of the speechless, presenting queries and claims on behalf of the weak party. For example, the court must challenge a note for collection issued against orphans, since unaware of their late father's business dealings, they can easily be victimized by swindlers.
Let's pause right there. Why does oral law exist? We're going to see it. We're going to see an oral law before the oral law was given on Sinai in the Torah portion day. Why does it exist?
For instruction.
What were you going to say? Yeah, go ahead. Hang on. Hold your bow for one quick sec.
My understanding was that before there were so many who were not literate, so if you're unable to read, you have the oral traditions and the oral laws that are handed down.
So I'm glad you're bringing that up. And here's that has very much been a Shabbat Shalom. That's very much been a teaching that has passed down.
It doesn't necessarily make sense if you have a rabbi or your father is teaching you.
Yeah.
Well,
no, that's fine. It's good. I don't need you. I don't want you to try and defend it or try and. What you said is, I'm glad you said what you said because that's an understanding that's out there that I'm glad you're bringing up. But here's the thing: the oral law. When you say that, it's almost like this idea of that because someone was illiterate, then we give them. It's almost like you're saying it's the Braille version for someone who's blind. Or the sign language for someone who's deaf, maybe. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Give it down for a second, yeah.
So the other thing that I should have said was that when Adam and Eve were in the garden, mm-hmm. and they had the presence of their father, they mm-hmm. weren't writing everything down. It was all oral. So,
right. So
then they pass it down to their children, and that's oral. And they pass it down to right. their children, and that's oral. Because as parents, we don't sit down and write all the rules for our kids because it would be a long list sometimes.
Exactly. Absolutely. And so I'm glad you're even bringing that up because, again, that lends to this idea of you're passing down what maybe at some what isn't written, which at some point may be written. And so we have just, it was passed down before it was written down. That's about sum up kind of where you're coming from? Okay. Let me give you a different definition, different understanding that you, when you see it, you'll recognize it. But what you're saying has been passed down and has been taken to say that people would use that, the an oral interpretation, to come against, to use it independent of Torah, or to use it in favor of Torah, or use it in a way that supersedes Torah, in place of Torah, instead of Torah. But that has nothing to do with it at all. The understanding is that if you know what the instruction is, how do you go about doing it? What do you do in Torah when it says that a woman who has no husband, what does she do? What's the first thing she does? Well, she goes back to her father. What if her father is dead? Well, she goes back to her brother. What if she has no brothers? Well, then she would go to a cousin. Or what if she didn't have any? And what if you get down and she just has nothing? How do we do this together to, how do we take Torah, how do we apply that Torah to this? How do we apply it to a woman whose father is not Torah following, and he won't take her back to take care of her? Or whose brothers are evil, and none of them want to have anything to do with her? Whose brothers are, like we read a few portions ago, whose brother won't perform gibum and raise up an heir for her? What do you do? So the oral, in particular, when you hear the word oral law, oral instruction, it's after Sinai. But there were things that were passed down from generation to generation, but they always were, always have been, how do we do Torah? How do we do the instruction of God? The instruction that God gave to Adam and Eve, hey, you can eat from here and here, you can do that and that, but don't do this. That was oral law. That was an oral law that was given. You could even have an oral law on an oral law, because then they could come together and say, well, Adam, well, Eve, we just heard what God said to do. How do we do this? Right. Well, because I know, Eve, that you were tempted by that fruit more so than I am, and you may go and grab it and give it to me, and if you grab it, I'm going to eat it too. So how about you just stay away? How about we build some fences around this to keep us both safe? How about that? And
I've got a comment. Because the rabbis say that in the garden, Adam and Eve did everything together. They walked together. They worked together. They slept together. They eat together. So when you do everything together and you're never separate, it kind of makes you think of how the snake came to Eve and tempted her. It was the first thing she did outside of doing it with Adam. Because they were always together, and everything they did was together. So it's a different way to look at how the snake caused her to think about something and act outside of that.
Yeah.
I never thought of that, but it clearly states in scriptures that when she grabbed the fruit off the tree, Adam was standing next to her and she says, here, try it.
Yeah, yeah. But they did it. It wasn't like they had agreed upon it prior.
No, firsthand. But he could have stopped her when he saw her reaching for the fruit, because they were together.
A lot of things could have happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can go a lot of different ways. Yeah, go ahead over there. Can you give them the, or Kate, give it to Casey behind you. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. That's the discussion part right there. Yeah.
So that's like saying she only had half a mind right there, right then and there.
Go on. I'm not saying that. Go on. Let me hear this. Flesh this out for me.
Instead of the two being one.
Yeah.
She was only half of herself at that moment. Instead of being thinking clearly.
She wasn't in oneness with her husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she was only half-minded. I mean, well.
Are you saying she was a half-wit?
No, you said that, but okay.
And now you know how we have trouble with communication. I always have to ask him, can you please explain that?
Right. What is, yeah.
But yeah. But it is an interesting point, though, is that we are supposed to be one. And if you mm-hmm. are together making decisions all the time and yeah. you decide to make a decision on your own, then you no longer have your partner.
Yeah, it can quickly
turn sour. I mean, that happens at home in marriages all the time. Right. Yeah. And so that's an interesting point, interesting way of putting it. But
yeah, absolutely.
It definitely reinforces how important it is to, you know, our term today, be on the same page.
Yeah.
To have clear communication, because in a longstanding relationship, you think, oh, I know what he thinks or I know what she thinks. But it bears repeating that you should actually talk about it.
Well, there's two verses in Bible, and one of them, I don't know if it uses the word echad or what, but it says that husband and wife are one. I don't know if the word echad is there or not. And probably, then it also says, because Yeshua was talking about why you shouldn't sleep with other people, and he says, don't you know that when you sleep with them, you become one?
One,
and the reason why I say that is it goes with what Larry is saying about her having half a mind, because she wasn't working in unison in one. And I had never really thought about them always being together, and somehow Eve got separated, because again, to me, it's something I never thought about to now, having gone through two failed marriages, is how important it is to be one with your mate, with your husband, with your wife, and to just make all decisions one.
Amen. And it gives another, and Luis has a comment here too, and we're not going to go down this road, but it also gives the idea in James. It says don't be, we're talking about being half-minded or a half-wit. It says don't be double-minded either. Oh, okay. We won't go down there. We have time. Go ahead, brother.
No, I go. Go ahead, please.
Oh, no, go ahead. Oh, no. Yeah.
I remember in one of the verses says that our enemy is so, you know, it's about us, you know. He's always thinking for the way
he can get us.
Get us. And then if in that case they were together, but just, you know, he probably told Adam, look over there.
Right, look.
It's really incredible, because, you know, in a couple of seconds, we probably can cause a lot of damage without, you know, without thinking.
Just that quick.
Just
that quick, yeah. And can you hand me the mic behind you? And last question or comment so we can get through this. I want to get through this one today. It's really good.
So, and you may not want to answer this now, and that's okay. To me was, okay, so if they were told to stay away from the tree in the midst of the garden, what were they doing there in the first place?
They were told not to eat of it.
Right, but what were they doing being close enough to it? Like, oh, if I'm supposed to stay away from it, then stay away from it.
Well, but he said don't eat it. He didn't say don't eat from it. He said don't. I'm sorry.
He didn't say
don't stay away from it. Excuse me.
Yes, he said don't eat from it. But if I'm supposed to stay away from the neighbor because the neighbor's a drug dealer, then I don't go and schmooze with the drug dealer.
But the idea is it's don't go and buy drugs from the drug dealer.
Right.
So then
I'm not going to have a lot to do with that drug dealer.
But if you're
both
trimming your bush.
Right. That's the thing.
Right.
And he's right there. Exactly. And that's the point I was going to make. It also says that the tree was in the center of. Right. So God didn't hide it. He didn't make it little. It was beautiful and succulent and appealing to want to eat. And it was right in the middle of things.
So then if they're supposed to be taking care of the garden.
Yes.
So then would they also be having to take care of the tree? Those are things I never thought of.
Yeah, I believe so. Yes. They don't eat.
Never
don't,
thought the, of
the
that.
Command
the
was
tree,
don't,
just don't eat.
Eat
it.
Right.
Don't eat of the fruit. So then brings up another question. Do you think God made the fruit just nasty and full of worms and everything where they wouldn't be tempted by it?
Well,
or beautiful and succulent and dripping with nice juices? Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just a quick comment. So in that case, when we look at that tree, then that gives us, we're supposed to take pause and think of what he said.
Exactly.
So then that's why it's attractive. So then we can say, oh, wait a minute, but he said this.
Mm-hmm. So,
we start having to stop and think. Mm-hmm.
And then you think, you get back to this thing again, too, is, okay, who am I listening to? Am I listening to God saying don't eat it? Or am I listening to the devil saying eat it?
So then it's an example of saying, here's the world.
Yeah.
Stay away from it. Be careful.
Yeah.
Take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that tree is an example of what the world has to offer.
Yeah.
And you can't see, here's another thing I wasn't going to get into, but I'm going to say this real quick, and I want to get back to reading, so I want to get through this. You can't show God how much you love him and how much he is first unless through difficulty and challenges you resist and do what he tells you to do. Mm-hmm. So this is why there is a hasatan, and I'm not going to get into that either. Because without a hasatan, then you wouldn't have to have something hard to choose not to do if everything was just easy and everything was, you know.
He is the embodiment of you have free will and the free will that he
gives
us.
Exactly. You have to. So if you're going to choose, you know, God, everything is to choose. And it's not choosing to let God do everything. It's choosing to do what? Be in partnership with him and work with him. Yeah, go ahead, Case.
Because angels in heaven don't have free will. They do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that wasn't a situation where when he fell, he got free will.
No, he chose to do what he did, and he did. And he talked ones into him.
Point, yeah.
Others
because
into
he couldn't
him,
have left in the first place if there wasn't.
He just, it says he decided to leave, and he did. Yeah, Linda, really quick, and then we're going to...
We're talking about this, all this echadness, and this.
Yeah. Echad really, means a oneness, just for, yeah.
And this really brings up to me, and it's just reverberating in my head like something at a huge rock concert, is the part about how Yeshua said, I am in my Father, and my Father is in me.
Right. Yeah.
And if you do what I say, I am in you. And the
you,
Father
right.
is in you. So we are supposed to be echad with him in all of our choices.
Yeah.
And that even
it's all your whole life
back to Adam and Eve.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. We shall love the Lord God with all of our mind, all our heart. You get to that. What part of your heart? The part that wants to do good and the part that wants to do bad. If you can bring them together to love God, that's where he wants you to be. Yeah.
You said that he got cast out, or he chose to leave, but the Bible says he got cast out.
No, he chose to leave and was cast out. It's kind of like, you know, you're in a house with your parents and you're causing a bunch of problems. You say, well, I'm leaving. They say, well, get out of here. And you say, let me help you out the door. It's that idea. I hate to use children in a bad way, but yeah. Real quick, Case, real quick, or we're not going
to
get through this.
Microphone back to Casey.
Yeah.
So he left by choice. So could he have stayed?
Not after that point. No, he was getting kicked out.
So he was cast out.
He did something to cause himself to be evicted, and it was too late then. And I want to say some other things, but I can't because there's no time. Okay, 2 seconds.
A lot of things that I want to say, but they're not PC. So
okay, wonderful. Okay, let me keep on reading here and just list because I want to get through this. Go ahead, Larry.
Oh, no, just...
Oh.
Passing it on.
Okay, hold on to it. Okay. Keep it just from her for about 3 minutes, and I can get through this, and she can have at it. All right, here we go. No, this stuff is wonderful. I'm appreciative of this. Where'd we leave off at? And I'm going to take over for Stacy. I'm going to read a little faster. She's nice and sweet and nice and slow, but we're out of time. Rashi views the metaphor of not acting as a counsel as further instruction to judges. A, prior to trial, they should not offer an opinion regarding any aspect of the case or the chances of a particular claim winning in court. And B, they may not announce the verdict unless both parties or their representatives are present. Some texts read, like the great judicial figures, a student should not act like a great legal scholar by offering his opinion in the presence of his teacher. Nor should a judge pressure litigants to use his court. The dictum applies not only The dictum applies not only to judges. One should not offer unsolicited legal advice to a litigant that will cause loss to another party. For a Torah scholar, it is improper to do so even on behalf of a relative. It is, however, permitted to offer such advice to prevent one's own relative from incurring loss. And again, when you look at this thing, we all, in some ways, at some point, we act as a judge. And we all are, in some ways, at some point, a litigant. One who's in the wrong, one who's in the right. One who just something bad happened, and man, I didn't mean to do that to you. What can we do to solve the situation? You know, my tree from my yard fell over your fence and landed on your car, but it only fell, the tree from my yard only fell because at the fence line you chopped off all the roots when you're digging your swimming pool and you made the tree weak. Yes, it's my tree, but you weakened the tree. Yeah, I know my tree fell on your property, but you had something to do with it too. How do we do this? I'm mad because I crushed Jewel's car in my tree. But I saw Jewel out there swimming last summer because he put this big old pool in, and I saw him with his big backhoe digging up the roots of the tree. What about that?
Well, see, the roots were ruining his yard, so he had to do something.
I didn't plant the tree. So you get into those situations too. So let's keep on going here. One way to constitute a court is for each of the litigants to choose one judge and for those judges in turn to agree on the third member of the tribunal. This mission admonishes two judges chosen by the litigants. Do not represent the position of the person who appointed you. Instead, you must act impartially and be open to all sides of the question. Hahasir Ya'avitz adds, do not act as a lawyer, employing your powers to debate and persuasion to justify the litigant whose position logically and instinctively seems to you to be correct. Objectively weigh only the claims and counterclaims presented by the involved parties and the testimony of bona fide witnesses. While litigants stand before you, consider them both as guilty. While the trial is in progress, a judge must be skeptical of all the litigants as if they were evildoers. This allows him to remain objective. To establish the authenticity of all statements made to the court and to ferret out with truth. Were the judge to view all sides as righteous and honest, he would never succeed in uncovering duplicity. Furthermore, the very involvement of both litigants in a situation of strife is, in most suitable fashion, indicative of evil. The use of the term stand refers to the practice of judges sitting in court while the litigants stand. Okay. But when they are dismissed from you, consider them both as innocent, provided they have accepted the judgment. As long as the parties are before the judge, he must view them both as equally unreliable and evaluate the allegations against them objectively, dispassionately, and without regard to personalities. This is hard to do. It's hard to be impartial. But he says, be impartial, solely on the merit of their testimony. For there are disputes in which even the best man may be in the wrong and the worst man in the right. On the other hand, once the parties have accepted the verdict, the judge must not carry into his civilian life any adverse impressions he may have subconsciously obtained of either party. He must regard them both as equally guilt-free. This is incredible. Lev Avos interprets the last two stitches of the Mishnah as conditional. If the litigants remain standing in front of the court, arguing and protesting the verdict, then the court should view them as wicked people who are unable to yield to true justice. However, if they leave the court fully accepting its decision, then they will both be seen as innocent people who have aligned themselves with truthfulness. Arbanel sees the Mishnah as qualifying the axiom of Yehoshua ben Perekiah, which states that one must judge everyone favorably. That rule is not to be applied to everyone at all times. Litigants, while before the court, are to be viewed as wicked. Viewing them favorably would becloud the judge's objectivity and cause him to function instead like a lawyer. Therefore, while they still stand in front of the court, they should be viewed negatively. Only after they accept the ruling of the court shall they again be viewed as innocent, and we must apply the words of Yehoshua ben Perakiah to judge them favorably. We, in an earlier mission, it talks about this idea of if you see a righteous man sinning, I think it says on Erev Shabbat, and then you see him on Shabbat, automatically assume that he's already repented. This is how do you want people to view you like that? Or should they automatically assume, man, you're just a big old sinner and you haven't changed? You're not close to God.
So does this go back to how we're taught that if someone comes into church or synagogue, you don't treat someone that you know is a
partiality. Yeah, that's part of it. So that's part of the idea. You know, see, here's the thing about within Judaism. I mentioned to you before, I keep bringing this up. There's always more to it. So you can't take one thing and make some big old, oh, well, look, some homeless person comes in, you set him in the back, but the mayor of the city comes in and you set him up front. That part is true. However, Yeshua also said, for you to take, if you go into a situation like that, for you to decide to take the lowest position and to sit in the back, and if you're invited up, then come up, right? So there's that part of it too. But if you do that and you're somebody of reputation within the community and you're invited up, should you go up? Yes. If you're a scoundrel in a community, you think you're going to be invited up? No. So what you're saying is true, but remember, it's part of it. It's not the whole, and this is the one thing I always tell, it's not the whole thing, part of it. There's a lot of, another hand back here and another hand here. There's a lot of that in here. And the last thing I want to read, go ahead and, is that not, so we got the strong one. Got the pages right here. And that's nine. So this is the last thing right here. Go ahead and read both of those, if you would.
Two hats. My Marom offers an insight into the dual characteristics necessary to ensure true justice. Human judges must follow the divine model in their approach to administering justice. Just as God, the true judge, is involved in the most intimate details of human affairs and simultaneously is totally separated from them. So the human judge must be intellectually fully aware of and empathetic towards the claims of the litigants, but he may not act as counsel for them and must remain totally impartiality. Hida in Zeroa, Yemen, extends this maxim to self-judgment. We tend to employ all types of convoluted arguments and hair-splitting logic to justify our shortcomings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes our creativity in arguing our innocence rivals that of the sharpest lawyer. The Mishnah is showing us that when we judge ourselves, we should not act as a lawyer who is unwilling to admit the guilt of his client. A person can never improve himself if he cannot face the reality of his shortcomings. Guilt is painful, but it is from such pain that spiritual health emerges. An evildoer. When our Yaakov Yosef of Square was a young man, an old Hasid asked him if he was considering entering the rabbinate when he grew older. The young man answered, "We are taught, while the litigants stand before you, view them as if they were evildoers. I am simply unable to view any Jew, or for even a moment, as an evildoer."
I like that. I like this idea of, I'm going to read this again. We tend to employ all types of convoluted arguments and hair-splitting logic to justify our shortcomings. Sometimes our creativity in arguing our innocence rivals that of the sharpest lawyer. The mission is showing us that when we judge ourselves, we should not act as a lawyer who is unwilling to admit the guilt of his client. We see this in the Brit Hadashah when it says when we do the Sudat HaAdon, the Lord's Supper, it says if we judge ourselves, we won't be judged. They had this understanding in mind. This is as Jewish as it gets. That had been passed down for, at this point, thousands of years, or at very least, many, many, many hundreds of years prior to Messiah. This was Judaism. A judge. Judge yourself. Judge yourself, really judge yourself as harshly as an evildoer, not as your own lawyer. But see yourself as. Any last thoughts or comments on this? Casey, then Linda. You have your mic? No, but go ahead.
So it's like the opposite of how it is today, where it's innocent until proven guilty.
The court system is innocent until proven guilty. That's how it's always been, because, again, you needed two or three witnesses, right? But the mindset and the way of operation of the judge is everybody's guilty, everybody did something wrong, and I've got to look at them like that so I don't have favoritism or partiality towards someone.
Yes.
You know, because I'm the judge and they're my brother, my sister, my wife, my child. I can't look at them like that, because automatically there's built-in partiality if I look at them like that. I've got to look at them as guilty, guilty, guilty for the time being within the framework of the court case, right? After that's done, then I look at them all. If they agreed with the ruling, if they said we're Jews who are under the authority of God and under the authority of those that God has put in authority, and we accept the verdict, and we take our lumps and move on about our lives peacefully, then he looks at them as though they're innocent. So then he sees you, you know, at the grocery store, and he's, oh, they're innocent. I'm not going to think about the innocent. They took the, yeah.
And what if you didn't accept the verdict?
Then you can still look at, so then you can't look at them as innocent, because they're arguing, because by them arguing with the verdict, what they're saying is we don't agree with the verdict of those and the system that God has put in place, that God has used to render this verdict. If we don't agree with it, we're disagreeing with God. How can we say that person is innocent? Yeah. You have a mic still? Yeah.
So I guess I'm thinking about when someone says, God is my judge, if he's righteous, it's a good thing. If he's not righteous, it's...
Yeah, it's
judgment
bad.
Judgment is coming.
It is. But you know, though, and even more so, when someone says that, you know what the biggest thing that they're saying is? That leave me alone. Don't say anything to me if you don't agree with me. That's what they're saying. And it's clear that a lot of people don't agree with them for them to even want to say that in the first place. Yeah, go ahead.
So,
yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was thinking in the context of how David writes in the Psalms, God is my judge.
I have to look at that in the whole context of it. But again, let's look at that, okay? Let's just look at the base idea of that. Here he is. He's a Jew who is under the covenants, who's righteous, whose heart is to serve God, right? Even when he makes mistakes, he comes back and he repents. His heart is to continue to serve. So then, you look at that. That's a different situation. And when God would render judgment situations, he didn't come against God or come against him. He accepted it, and he said, God, help me through it, basically was his attitude about it. Go ahead, Case.
Well, my question was going to be, so this is righteous judgments, because it's tough. So would this apply to non-practicing Jews, like in that kind of court?
I would say this, make a blanket statement. anything that has to do with right and wrong and judgment, it applies to everyone on a, what's the word I want to, I don't want to say universal, but on a, there's a word I cannot find right now, but I'll think about it later on. No. Let me explain another way. When you look at scripture, most scripture, the very, very vast majority, who's it talking to? Jewish people. Well, it's talking to Jewish people specifically. But not universal. I keep missing the word. There's a word I'm trying to think of. It applies to everyone. You can find yourself in it and know that God said to the Jewish people, don't steal. Do you think that he only meant to the Jewish people, don't steal? No, but specifically he told them that. Okay. So there's more of a, they've got more, there's more expectations on the Jewish people than on Gentiles. I put it to you like that. But that doesn't mean it's okay. You know, we talk about this idea of even like quote unquote kosher foods. When the law was given regarding foods, who was it given to? Who was it told to? It was given to the Jewish people. The expectation upon them is totally different than Gentiles. Gentiles, we get to come in not because we're obligated to do it, because we decide to do it, because we decide we want to be obedient, closer. And we can't keep kosher. There's no way. But the big things we can do, we can do the big things. We can do the best. And this gets back to the best you can do. The best you can do. Yeah. Hang on. Yeah.
Well, I just want to comment about this issue right now on this past days that happened, the shootings.
Yeah.
And then also the police that, you know.
Yeah.
Like, on the shootings, right? They're in jail. They're going to have millions to get out from jail, right? Because yeah. They killed a few people. And then on the police, they mm-hmm. did it in front of cameras also.
Mm-hmm.
But how they get out from, you know, to be in jail, to be, you know, just to mm-hmm. still play, to fight, you know, like.
How do they even get out?
Yeah, if we all see what they did.
Yeah.
So this is kind of the symbol, the law right now is kind of.
Yeah, it can. Them. Yeah, it's a terrible situation. In particular, I mean, those are two totally different situations. But you're talking about the thing in, with the young guy who got killed out here in the U.S. is terrible. And there are things I can say I wouldn't say recording. But what I can say in a recording is this. How is it biblically that we show our love for God? How did he say? By how we treat other people.
Amen.
Remember, we talked about this idea in the Torah portion a few weeks ago, this idea that God would rather step back and allow someone to see a marriage together that's happy and is godly, because when people look upon that, what do they see? They see that marriage is demonstrating the love of God and the power of God on the earth. And so it's the same kind of thing. When you see baseless hatred, we talked about this idea of when the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly, came together and they said, what happened here? We're in exile. Just a while ago, we were in Jerusalem. We had our temple and we were able to go and worship God. Now the temple's been destroyed and we're in Iraq. What happened? And in their discussions, they came to the conclusion that the temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred. So then the opposite of that needs to be done, right? Which is baseless love. Which is what? Doing the mitzvot. Which is what Yeshua said. When you see your brother and he's freezing, I'm paraphrasing, in the cold, and you've got a couple jackets and you're warm, he has nothing, then give him a jacket. When you see him starving and you've got food, well, give him some food. You know, when you see the, you know, he goes on the whole story, the parable of the Good Samaritan. A lot of religious people who said they love God and serve God, they did nothing to help the guy. But someone that they hated came and helped him. Yeah. But they didn't, though. Yeah.
Said that they would be unclean.
So they yeah, but that, the other side. That's a good point. And see, we keep going into deeper and deeper things here. But it's okay to become tamei or unclean in certain situations. Yeshua did. Yeshua had to go to the mikvah of John the Baptist. Why? Well, you see earlier what happened. The woman with the issue of blood, she came and touched him. This is why when the Torah goes around, we ask women not to touch it. Because no rabbi wants to ask them, are they on their monthly? Because during that time, they're unclean. So a woman never touches. A woman would just take her sleeve and touch. Or a siddur, which we don't have here. You can use your Bible. That's the reason, because it makes, it's a contamination. Is it a sin? No, it's unclean. So they couldn't do their job. But this is the high priest specifically needs to remain. But the regular Levites, different ones, it doesn't matter. It's not so much. They could go and do a mikvah. They don't have the same level of expectation to stay ritually pure, to do their job.
But if they're unclean, then they couldn't do their job that day.
Yeah, they could. They could go and they could do a mikvah and go and do the process of... But the idea is that Torah is always about doing good. And should you heal, what should you do on Shabbat? What's good? Should you heal someone on Shabbat? Yes, because it's good. Should you help somebody, one of your brothers, mind you? Imagine that I saw one of you guys just laying in a ditch on Shabbat, and I just passed by you and said, sorry, I got too much stuff to do. Then imagine someone who you hated, who hated you, walked by, and they saw you, and they helped you up, and they took you somewhere, and they paid to take care of you. That's that situation, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say that the Samaritan hated the Jew. I feel like it was the other way around. Jews looked down on Samaritans because obviously they didn't, or most didn't.
So this is a lesson we'll be teaching in the coming months, but let me give you a little taste of it. Because they warred with each other about the location of the temple, for one. And so they're cousins who hated each other. Yes.
But we're not talking about a Samaritan who was a believer.
Samaritans were basically half Jews, roughly, who didn't practice true Judaism, who had their own temple, who were separated from the house of Israel. And there were wars and they hated each other. During the time of the Maccabees, during the time of Hanukkah, they fought all the time. And you had Yehuda, you know, Maccabee, he was killing Jewish people. He was killing his brothers and sisters for not keeping Torah. Let alone the Samaritans who they hated. They hated each other. They were bitter family who hated each other. But I don't want to get too much in that because we're already over time. Last question or thought? What are you thinking, Joel? Because I can see you're...
I'm just watching her talk, not
thinking. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, though. That's a good... There were hundreds or thousands of them. They were always top. So this idea of tamei, ritually impure, happened all the time. I mean, you could go to the mikvah and be clean, then all of a sudden you go to the bathroom, you sit on a toilet seat. Unclean! You know, you didn't wash your hands properly. Unclean! You know, you accidentally touched something dead that you weren't supposed to. Unclean! You actually had someone run up to you, hey, how are you doing? Hug you. Unclean. Constantly. Staying clean was almost impossible, but it was the best they can do, yeah.
So it's basically an excuse.
They didn't want to do it, and they, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but see, again, we get to this idea of baseless hatred, baseless love. Here it is, you have a Samaritan, should have some hatred towards the Jew there. Maybe even think, oh, you know, it's good, you got what you deserved, right? But no, he doesn't. He uses the exact opposite. He remembers what happened to the temple too. Because remember, now the temple's been rebuilt. They've already decided it's baseless hatred. And he's got his own temple on Mount Gerizim. But yet, what does he do? He still goes and he helps his cousin, who he doesn't get along with. He shows baseless love, regardless of how he felt. You can hate somebody and have very bad feelings for somebody in here, and then go do a mitzvah out here and help them. Look at my neighbor, man. That guy, but he's stuck in a ditch down there, and he can't. His car won't get out. I'm gonna go and help him out. You ever have that? Same kind of thing. That's that guy who said something mean about my wife. Look at him. Lord, I gotta go help. I know you want me to help him out. Those are the times that you show you really love God, is when you do the mitzvah when it's hard. Yeah, go ahead, Case, and we're gonna.
So is the understanding that he was a practicing Samaritan who knew that it was Shabbat and decided to help him anyway, or a non-practicing Samaritan who just helped him because
I don't have it in front of me to look, but the whole idea of it, the big idea, is that he was a Samaritan and he was helping a Jewish man when even the Jews who should have been the ones practicing Haknasat he was almost treating him as a guest because he took him to, when they should have been practicing the hospitality, should have been practicing looking out for your fellow Jew, should have been practicing, hey, well, how are we going to make it in the diaspora? We're going to stay together. Should have been doing, they weren't. And who was it? Who did it? The one who was least likely to be the one who did it. He actually did it, and then he went above. He didn't just take him out of the ditch and get him home and say, see ya. He sent him to a hospital and told the people, hey, look, take care of the guy. I'll be back here in a week or two, and I'll pay you whatever it costs when I come back. What's that?
That's your neighbor.
Yeah. So who in this story is my neighbor?
Exactly.
That was the one who was neighborly. Mm-hmm. Proximity to you doesn't make you a neighbor. Right. How you treat someone makes you a neighbor, or how you treat people makes you a neighbor to them. Yeah.
And many times in this current day, when you have someone that you have out against and you see them in the wrong, or you see them hurting and you go help them, a lot of times it will heal the differences between them, because
exactly,
if the neighbor had out against you, then by your stepping above the frustration you may have had, or the anger or the resentment you may have had to help them, mm-hmm, breaks a wall down.
Yeah.
And you may not become friends, but the resentment is gone.
It just kills it. And it's interesting because Jewel brought up this idea a week or two ago about the honey. Mm-hmm. And so biblically, we see honey is always represents something good, mm-hmm, and something sweet. But also honey is very, has curative properties. If you take honey and put on a wound, it'll help heal it. It protects,
heals burns.
And honey is something that's hard to come by. You have to sacrifice a lot to get it. You've got to wait a lot of time. Mm-hmm. We talked about this idea of Yochanan the Immerser when he was out living in the desert. And it says he lived on locusts and wild honey. The bees didn't just fly over and just drip, drip, drip honey in his mouth. He had to go fight the bees and get past the bees and get stung and everything, mm-hmm, to get the honey. Mm-hmm. He didn't have like a modern honey beekeeper's suit and a little thing of smoke. He didn't have any of that. He came back stung, and it's a good thing he had on his clothing of camel's hair, that thick skin to help him not get stung. You think he remained unstung? And when it says he lived on it, it didn't say, you know, it was Shabbat and he just went and got him a little drop of honey. It said he lived on it in the desert. You know how many locusts you have to eat? Yeah, you want to have some honey-dipped locust? Something sweet to eat? Yeah, right. It is, but he ate locusts. It's the only kosher insect. Huh? Yeah, and it's a Middle Eastern thing. They eat. They still eat them. Yeah. Yeah.
Are they crunchy?
If you deep fry them.
Let us know.
Right, yeah. in the Middle East, yeah, I mean, you're eating, that's a yeah, it's something that is, what am I trying to say? It was abundant enough to eat. If you had to eat in the wild, there was locusts and there was honey. You could find a beehive, you know, follow the bees back to where they're flying from, you know? Yeah. Yeah, ask, well, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but no, it's something that is all over the place. That's a big thing in Judaism because what's interesting, see, I'm going to say this and I got to stop because we're running out of time. Look at this. Locust is the only edible insect, okay? A bee is not kosher to eat. However, you get the spit of a non-kosher insect is a delicacy to eat. So, Father, we thank you and praise you for this time we've had together, and we ask you to help us to continue to move forward in you. And we look forward, oh God, to having another good time serving you, worshiping you, oh God, as we continue our service today, and as we continue to have fellowship with one another, as we learn more and more about you, and we are here together today to live in peace. We're here together to live in community. We're here together today to show each other unmerited favor and to show each other, thank you, baseless love, so that we practice here, oh God, we can leave here. We know how to treat people that we may even hate, oh God, or have bad feelings in our heart regarding, Lord. So we thank you when we come together on Shabbat, Lord, it's a day to practice Hagnasat Orhim, practice goodness, practice Chesed, oh God, as we go out into the world during the week. So we thank you for this in Yeshua's name. Amen and amen.